welcome to this week's episode of Get the Fork Out. We have with us Neil Walker, who is a professional yacht chef, and he just got finished making lunch. That's how professional he is. He just banged out lunch, cleaned it up, and now we're going to have a little talk about his prolific Instagram page and how he manages to organize seats at some of the best restaurants in the world. It's pretty incredible. Welcome, Neil Walker. How you doing, man?
Yeah, good. Good, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. How's Stockholm?
Of course. Stockholm was very cold. I did an ice plunge today. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's hardcore. Okay.
Yeah, it was easier than I thought. I'm kind of spending time with my Viking friend, and she encouraged it. It was quite fun. Where are you? Like, what part of the sunny Caribbean at 12 noon, 6 hour time difference?
We're in Antigua. We're sort of doing a quarantine circuit breaker attempt in Antigua at the moment to try and shake off a bit of COVID that's been happening. Everyone's fine, yeah. But just trying to sort of be in a position where we can move the boat, so yeah, we're just doing that at the moment, and then probably heading to the States towards the end of the season, and then back over to the Med for hopefully a busy charter season.
There will be. Yeah, I think everyone's kind of over the COVID restrictions at this point, especially, I mean, Omicron ripped through our boat too, all at once, you know, right starting before New Year's, and then no one got sick. It was just kind of a chest tickle. So who knows, man?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. It'll all work out. It'll all work out. And then where did you get, I don't know, when did you start cooking? What inspired you to start, you know, picking up a knife in the saute pan?
You want the Neil Walker origin story?
Yes.
Grew up on a military base in Borneo. My parents were assassins, that sort of thing.
Wow.
No, I'm kidding. I kind of fell into yachting about 15 years ago, having been sort of, well, cooking since I left school, starting out as a line cook in some pretty shitty sort of American theme restaurants. Pubs in my local area. Then started doing ski seasons, did about 11 ski seasons.
Wow.
Realized that it's a good job to, a good profession to have to be able to travel. So I love traveling. So I went to Australia, went to Canada, Austria, France, worked all around there. And then worked with a guy who was doing sort of winter in the mountains and then summer on a yacht in Antibes. And he suggested that I go down, and the rest is history, really. It's been sort of 15 years now in the industry. A bitter old yacht chef, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you don't sound that bitter, and all these places that you mentioned really fit into your assassin origin story. And I mean, do you have much contact with Borneo anymore? Or it's actually called Kalimantan.
I was kidding. I was a joke.
I know.
Bad
I know.
Joke.
No, it was a good one. It was a good one. So 15 years in the yachting industry. I mean, surely you've had some pretty grim tales from the beginning of your time, as we all do. I think very few of us get lucky. And it's the first boat is a good boat. It's usually a boat that no one else wants.
Yeah. I think I've had it pretty lucky, really. I have been very lucky, really. I've been on some good boats. Nothing out of the ordinary other than the usual, you know, charter sort of stuff, getting woken up at 3 a.m, all that stuff that we all do. So I moved up. My first boat was a 24-meter Sunseeker, where I was deck chef, just free crew.
Slash.
Yeah, and then... Now we're on a 70-meter sort of charter new build. But everything in between has sort of been gradually moving up in size and you know, towards busy charter boats, which is what I'm all about at the moment. And
I'm there with you.
Yeah.
I get it when chefs say I only want to do charter. Like I feel the same, and probably for very similar reasons.
Yeah, I think it gives you a broader spectrum of what you're cooking, and there's always a new challenge every week. So one week you're doing classical classical whatever for a bunch of guests, and the next week they want, you know, Chinese banquets and stuff. So it's interesting in that respect.
Yeah, it's always changing as well. Like, and it's, I don't know about you, but like certain charter guests have brought me to strange parts of Food Town I never would have gone to before, and you end up liking that part of Food Town. Like, oh, this is interesting arena to be in. But yeah, I like the teamwork aspect of it too. I think it's a little more tighter on a charter boat than a private boat. Broad generalization, but my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. The yachting in general sort of links nicely into what I do outside of work, because I'm still obviously the yacht's traveling around all the time with me on it, so I get to travel to, you know, new restaurants that I haven't seen before in different countries, different parts of the world, while I'm working as well as while I'm not working. So it's ideal for me.
Yeah, and then I'm sure. Let's dive into it right now. I mean, you have a pretty epic Instagram page, and it's just like you accessing these amazing Michelin star restaurants and taking photos. It's a really cool page. I mean, to go check it out and be able to see these places. It's pretty awesome. How did that idea like come to fruition? Were you like, how did that start? How the idea of it? And I mean, I'm sure as a chef, you're eating out at Michelin star restaurants anyway. And then you're like, well, I might as well record it for people. Or how did it come down to it?
I kind of started destination dining, as in sort of organizing short trips for myself specifically to go to restaurants about 10 years ago. And then I enjoyed taking photos of the food from a photography perspective. So I liked making a dish look really nice in a photograph. And then obviously Instagram is a great forum, a great platform to be able to store all that stuff. And then, you know, I started doing my own little kind of thoughts. I won't call them reviews, but just what I thought about the restaurants that I go to on both Instagram and Facebook. I think it sort of slowly grew and grew and grew to where it's at now. It's just, so it's like 42,000 followers at the moment. And I get quite a lot of interaction with chefs and restaurants and other diners that are sort of dining as much as I do, which is great. And on the back of that now, I'm sort of organizing restaurant tours. So I've got 2 months leave coming up end of February, and I've already sort of organized basically a 2 month non-stop restaurant tour, nine countries, I think 70 restaurants booked so far.
Holy shit.
What I'd add also is I'm not sort of Michelin star chasing. There's a lot of stuff in there there's lots of casual dining in there as well, but the rule of thumb is there are restaurants that I want to visit. So I'm specifically going to a place to visit that restaurant rather than try and bag all the 3 Michelin stars or whatever.
Okay.
It's a fun hobby. A bit expensive.
I'm sure. You know. So how are you going to do 70 restaurants in 60 days? I mean, you're going to be full, man.
I mean, lunch and dinner 60 days, that's 120 meals.
I know, but like I can't, you know, but it's hard to do both for me, like to do a lunch and do a dinner. Oof. Depends.
I've been burned a lot planning, so it's super fun actually planning the trips. It takes a long time, and you have to try and bag all these reservations and get them in the right order. So the first 2 weeks of the trip, we're driving from there's a 3-star in Valence called Maison Pic, and we're basically getting some nice cars and driving from there all the way to Lech in Austria over a couple of weeks, and sort of stopping at all the best restaurants along the way. So that takes quite a bit of planning in itself. And one thing I've learned, back to your point, is to not book 2 big meals in a day, because it's always a disaster. Yeah. You have amazing lunch, you're wasted, you have incredible food, Yeah. And then, of course, you're like stuffed to rock up for dinner at this incredible restaurant, and you feel super bad not being able to finish the meal. It makes you a bit of an asshole, really.
Yeah.
So now, I try and keep it to, if it's a big, important restaurant that we're going to, like a super hard to book, 3-star that we've wanted to go to for a while, then it probably won't have lunch at all. Or if we do, then it'll be like a casual place. You know?
Yeah, super basic.
Just a super light lunch, yeah.
That timeline is pretty interesting. I think I have a bunch of questions for you, but one of them relates to, I mean, getting the reservations all in a row has got to be tricky. And I think other chefs, I think people into fine dining or just food in general want to know what resources that you lean on, not just Michelin Guide, because that's the basis of that guide, is like the restaurants that are good enough to travel to, 3-star being it's worth a trip on its own rather than, you know, we do it on the way. So other than that, what else do you use? San Pellegrino, I'm sure. And then.
Yeah. I mean, to pick the restaurants, there's lots of resources now, as you know. So Michelin's a good benchmark as a guide. They're pretty reliable because the judges, the inspectors on Michelin are unique in one respect, that they're completely impartial. They've got no skin in the game when they're inspecting the restaurants, you know. Whereas, say, World's 50 Best, these big restaurants have PR budgets. They have PR managers inviting World's 50 Best taste hunters to their restaurants. They'll fly them out to the restaurant, show them a good time.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not every restaurant, but. So there's restaurants that are definitely gunning for the number one spot, and there's ways of increasing your chances.
Yeah.
So when you look at the world's 50 best, when you look at 50 best list, sort of take that into consideration. But I mean, also it is also a very, basically, you're not going to have a bad meal in a restaurant that's on that list, unless you're super picky and you go to Mirrors after having been like a few times and it's changed for the worse. But generally,
yeah.
I mean, if anyone goes to any of those restaurants, they're going to have a good time. There's like other resources. OAD is a website and guide called Opinionated About Dining. And that's, I review restaurants for them. And their list of top 100 recommended restaurants is based on people like me visiting the restaurants and scoring them out of 10, essentially. And the more restaurants you visit and the further afield you travel, the more sort of a heavier weight your score that you give a restaurant is taken into account. So if you're eating at 200 restaurants a year all over the world, then and you vote for a restaurant, then it's higher likelihood of getting on the top 100 list than, say, a person that eats in one meal a year, you know. So that's another good way of judging restaurants and using that resource, because again, we don't have any skin in the game. We're completely impartial. We're paying for all our meals. So it's not like, hey, I'm going to vote for your restaurant if you give me a free meal, which is sometimes the case. You get these idiots on TripAdvisor like phoning up restaurants and say, hey, I've got this amount of followers on Instagram, or, you know, I'll give you a really good review on TripAdvisor if you give me some free drinks or stuff like that. I've digressed quite a lot there, but I think
no, please, that was super interesting. Like, I've never heard of I'll admit to my ignorance, I've never heard of Opinionated About Dining, and now I'm going to look into that, because that's fantastic, because it's community based, it's legitimate, like it's somewhat, it's not anonymous, but it's impartial, where Michelin's going to go hardcore French all the time, San Pellegrino's going to go Italian, like there's certain biases built into those two systems, where I feel like Opinionated About Dining maybe has less, or at least different ones, so that, you know, between all three and whatever else that you may clue us into, they can get a good idea of like what actually is shit hot right now this year, and what has recently been reviewed really well.
Yeah, I mean, I So as well as those resources, I mean, a few sort of Facebook forums where you get a couple of hundred food geeks, basically food journalists and some other chefs and some food writers and just enthusiastic diners that have been sort of, because it's fairly small world, like yachting really, like the amount of people that eat out as much as some of the people in these groups, it's actually quite small. So those groups, we chat about restaurants, we chat about new openings. So I sort of get intel from those groups and those people. Also following like restaurant critics, I'll keep an eye on where they're eating, because they're usually the first people to get heads up of you know, what good restaurants are opening, or, you know, chefs are moving around and stuff like that.
Are there restaurant critics that you respect and appreciate, and on the other side of that, are there ones that you loathe that are just like either corruptible or uneducated? Or
Marina O'Loughlin for the Sunday Times, I've got a lot of time for. Jay Rayner, The Guardian, I like reading him because he's entertaining, but I just always get the impression he doesn't like eating out very much. And he's always banging on about the price point and you know, but I enjoy his reviews as a writer. Andy Haler, who's got a website, he's one of the guys that's eaten at every 3-star in the world, along with a guy called Gerhard Huber. So he's another good impartial sort of self-imposed restaurant critic, basically. He has a website that he's built himself. He doesn't work for a newspaper or a magazine. It's just like a hobby for him.
All right.
Actually made a bunch of money with Shell Oil or something like that. He designed a piece of software for them and then retired ages ago, and now just eats, basically, and has his website. But a lovely guy and very useful to sort of see what's good, especially in the UK and France. He's always one to sort of follow and see where he's eating and see what's good.
Are there any, before you leave that topic, are there any reviewers that are like French or Italian or Scandinavian that you obviously write in English so that we can all kind of take in their ideas, because it's going to be English skewed, whatever writers you and I both read, it's going to be usually British in Europe and American in the US. And so they're going to gravitate towards a certain type of restaurant. So it would be kind of nice to balance that out with someone that was native born European, English as second or third language, but they could still write entertaining shit. You know, you don't want it to be this broken English either.
Off the top of my head, the person that springs immediately to mind is Anders Hussar, who's based in Copenhagen. So he writes a lot about, he has a website called, I think it's just andershussar.com. But he covers all of Scandinavia, basically. So he has a really good site with, you know, maps of city guides and maps of the cities, and you can use filters to search for the type of restaurant you're after, or type of, if you want a natural wine bar, or if you want like a fine dining restaurant, or if you want a casual restaurant but that's open on a Monday lunchtime, which is extremely difficult in Scandinavia. Everywhere seems to be closed on Mondays.
That's what I'm finding in Stockholm now. It's like everything's closed on Mondays, and then it looks like also Tuesdays, if they open up, they won't do lunch on Wednesday. So it seems like the higher end places, the week starts Wednesday dinner, and then Thursday they'll start with lunch service and dinner service together.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I get stuck all the time planning a non-stop tour, because everywhere's shut on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, especially the big restaurants that you want to hit. So it's quite enjoyable challenge trying to find good places that are open on those days.
Because oftentimes those are the easiest reservations to get, the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday ones, because I see how you're up against it. Because like, I got to get the coveted Friday, Saturday ones and then try to find something, which are, those are hard to get regardless, no matter how far you plan ahead.
Yeah,
I get it. And then there's this huge blank spot straight after that where you got to fill time and find restaurants that are open that are worth being on the road trip.
Yeah. I mean, often those are the gems though, because the guys that have to open on Mondays and Sundays and Mondays and Tuesdays are probably some of the guys that kind of push and get a little bit more recognition. So they're open. They can't afford to shut for 3 days a week, like the restaurants that you're talking about that are like solidly booked for 3 months in advance. So sometimes you can find some real gems, like Etem in Stockholm that I've recommended to you. I'm pretty sure that's open on a Monday. And we found that on our last trip to Stockholm because we were like desperately looking for somewhere open on a Monday. And ended up sitting in the guy's kitchen having a fantastic lunch. So it's, you can find some interesting places that way.
I think I'm going to extend my time here partially for that reason as well, because I was going to leave on Wednesday, but what's the point? Yeah, I kind of missed some really good. I also want to go to this brewery that I like, and it's fashioned in an old church, Omnipolo. So I want to go see a brewery in a church for sure.
Yeah, sounds good. No, Stockholm's a good city. Stockholm's a great city.
It's amazing.
To eat in.
Yeah, all of Scandinavia as well. I just find the food is such a high level. It reminds me of being in Barcelona, where bad food doesn't fly here. It just doesn't exist. Like, you can really kind of sniff out a good food quite easily. Even in the kind of college parts of town, it's still fun. It's still, it's just high level. I really enjoy it. Yeah,
I mean, Spain as a whole, I think Spain's probably my favorite country to eat in. Spain or Japan. Yeah, they just have a different food culture in Spain, which has brought about this incredible food scene across the whole country. You can't get a bad meal anywhere really in Spain. And that's right from especially casual, like local places, all the way up to your fine dining. And then you have the sort of El Bulli effect with all these young chefs now that are doing this sort of avant-garde multi-course tasting menus of just mind-blowing shit that you won't find really in France or Italy. Fantastic country.
That's we'll be doing 2 weeks. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, like, part of the tour that I've got coming up, we're doing 2 weeks in Spain also.
Hell yeah. I want to travel more around Spain. So far, I've just been to Tarragona and Girona and Barcelona and eaten quite prolifically in each one of those places. But I want to do like a motorcycle tour around Spain and just really, I want to go to San Sebastian for the food festival or not, or just go to San Sebastian because it sounds amazing and breathtaking.
Yeah.
But what I was going to ask you, but you mentioned the El Bulli effect. Like, I do think those two gentlemen, and I met Albert twice by accident, they've changed the world of food. And I think they're going to be in culinary textbooks from now on about people being proud of where they're from rather than opening up a French cafe or a Italian trattoria. It's just like, just cook what's from there, be proud of it and do it to a really high level.
Yeah, for sure. Those guys and Red Zeppi, of course.
There's a protege
hugely influential. True.
So, how did this, because I really appreciate that you've started the Instagram, because it's such a good idea. I wish I had it. I've also eaten at probably not nearly as many as you, but it'd be nice to have a record of all these dishes, all these plates and just a timeline of your food experience. And as that goes forward too, you might see that food changing a lot and gathering speed in a different direction. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting going back to restaurants that you visited years and years ago and watching them sort of evolve, like from Noma One, like 10 years ago when I first went, all the way to what it is now. Alchemist, when Rasmus was just like a 8-10 seat little counter, and now he's got this enormous what I think will be number one on San Pellegrino in the next couple of years for sure. It's exciting watching those chefs sort of evolve in their style, and when they're also given a bigger sort of canvas to paint their ideas on. Franzen as well as another one. Franzen was just a tiny little restaurant in the old part of Stockholm, and now with some backing, he's got this enormous luxurious 3-story 5-6-7 hour dining experience.
Amazing.
It is really good.
What, because I've been to Noma as well, like, why don't you, I mean, they're probably not as intimate with it as someone that has worked there, but like, what have you seen change in Renee's food and Noma from when they were number one and then kind of dipped down, and they've only just recently gotten 3 stars, which is a little bit of a joke because I ate there 10 years ago and definitely could have been 3 stars back then. I'm not sure what they were, Michelin thought they were missing, but.
Yeah, Noma is a funny one. I think the general consensus among the food geekery that I've chat about this stuff with is, yeah, like you said, they've been worthy of 3 stars for a long time, but I'm happy that they've finally got there and the number one spot as well. But in terms of evolution, I think, because, I mean, the service is incredible, obviously. In terms of the food, I think it's still based around, you know, locality and foraging, using what's around you or what's around the restaurant or what's in the region. I think the main thing that he's changed is now doing the seasonal menus. So it's even more seasonal in terms of it's just a seafood season, just a vegetarian season, or just like a forest and game season.
Yeah.
So he's sort of honing it more into sort of hyper-seasonality of ingredients and not trying to work with ingredients that aren't necessarily at their peak at that time of the year. Which, that influences a bunch of restaurants that do the same sort of thing. It'd be interesting to see what Noma does next.
Let me interrupt you for a bit because I want to just tell you or tell whoever's watching, like, one of the most impressive things that I thought about Noma was that they're dealing with their far north. They're dealing with a long winter, maybe 6 months of winter. So I went there with a bunch of chefs and we got a tour of the kind of laboratory, which I'm sure has changed by now. And just briefly to give kind of insight, and you touched on it, the head chef, I can't remember his name. It wasn't Renee. I was like, what do you do in winter? He's like, well, we got about €500,000 worth of stuff in the freezer and €500,000 worth of stuff in the dry stores to get us through. And that's what you touched on, where now they're just focusing on like maybe a better way to get through winter without having these kind of products that were picked in the summer at peak freshness, but now they're dried or pickled or fermented and they're getting through it in a different way.
Yeah, for sure.
One of the coolest things we had there was like, and it was a bunch of chefs at the table, it was like 12 of us. And just the simplicity of this dish was amazing. It was just a kind of mason jar full of ice and then a prawn about that big that was flipping around and you had to grab it and eat it, dip it in a like a brown butter creme fraiche. And that was it. It's awesome. It was the experience of sharing that together, of that awkwardness, of the uncomfortableness of like, oh, all right. Yeah, it was really fun.
Yeah. So, great restaurant.
Do you have a favorite? Does it change?
Trying to pick your favorite kid. I guess.
Great analogy.
I get asked a lot what your favorite restaurant is. There's different types of restaurants. There's different, and you have different experiences at these restaurants. So I always say Alchemist at the moment. In terms of a fine dining sort of restaurant, multi-course tasting menu experience. That's my favorite. But then there's Echebarri in Spain, which is out in the Basque countryside, which is probably my other favorite restaurant, just purely for the food. It's just a local guy who actually bought his own. I think it used to be the local bar, and it was in one of those tiny Spanish villages where the bar was the one central sort of communal point where everyone would meet up, and that's where you'd talk about shit.
And the watering hole.
Then it, yeah, exactly. So and then it closed, and he decided that he wanted to keep it open, so he bought it, and then basically taught himself to cook, and now he's one of the hardest reservations in the world. Really, it's super hard to get a table there, and it's just a fantastic experience. Yeah, Heston. I don't know why Heston is so difficult to book, because it's.
He bought it. He bought the place not knowing how to cook. Toured around the best restaurants you can get into. Then he learned that way, and then worked 19 hours a day or more.
Absolutely. Yeah, a bit like that. Yeah, and when you talk about your favorite restaurants, it's always about the experience that surrounds the meal as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be the best dish you've ever had. Doesn't necessarily mean it's the best restaurant for you. You know, I've got some really fun memories of Echeverry with groups of people. We've spent the whole afternoon there eating and drinking nice wine, and those are the ones that I remember, you know, 8, 9, 10 years later. Whereas I don't necessarily remember that incredible dish that I had last week. I probably remember it last week, but you know, this year that was just a 10 out of 10 perfect dish. But it was, you know, I was on my own, and it was, just a sort of like, so that's kind of how I sort of think about restaurants when I think about which ones are my favorites. It's, you know, where did I have the best time, you know, where the food was good also.
Yeah. And who are you with? I mean, it is. I've never thought of it that way. You're completely right, though. I've had amazing meals on my own. Like Per Se stands out as one of the best meals I've ever had alone. And that was when it was, that was a long time ago. It was like 10, 12 years ago when it was pretty red hot on the scene. And, but the meals I've had with other people, and it's just like, it changes the whole kind of aspect of dining, isn't it? And that's up to us. There's no reflection at all in the restaurant. It's like, well, who did we decide to eat with?
Yeah. It's nostalgia brings a lot into it. You know, if you have fond memories of a place, then you know it's going to stick in your mind. That'll be your favorite.
Yeah. What on this tour you have planned? Does any of them stick out as like? I mean, these are, you know, kind of the I can't wait to dine there either again or for the first time.
The Alpine stuff. So the first 2 weeks along the Alps, I've been to most of the places there, but not for a long time. So I'm looking forward to going back. And the main, well, not the main thing, but one of the things about that is I mentioned I did a bunch of ski season. So I love the mountains. I love being in the mountains and driving around, you know, be like a couple of hours drive every day from the last restaurant to the next restaurant, driving through ski resorts and stuff. I love that. So that's, you know, that'll be great. And then in Spain, a lot of the places in Spain I haven't been to before. So we're going to Andalusia, which is a region I haven't really explored. Found a bunch of restaurants that other people that I know have been to and are sort of starting to shout about. So we'll book those. And then the same with the rest of the trip. It's kind of a mishmash of because I always want to go back to my favorites. That's why they're your favorites, because you want to go back. But then I do try actively to seek out places that I haven't been to before and try them out.
Wow, that's incredible. Is there a resort town in the Alps that you think is like a San Sebastian? It's just like, just everything's high level.
Yeah, not really. There's usually like one amazing high-end fine dining restaurant in the resort. And then there might be like a couple of other casual places. And then because it's a ski resort and the nature of a ski resort is a bunch of tourists piling in for a week's holiday.
Yeah,
the rest of it's kind of turn and burn, So that's why you end up sort of going to a couple of places in Chamonix, then driving to Tien for one place, then driving to Val d'Isère for the other one place, and then another 2 hours to Courchevel or something there's a couple of places there. But everything's not too far away. So if you're willing to like drive around, then
and beautiful then drives as well. Really epic mountain drives. I definitely get the attraction. Yeah. And so that's one thing that Scandinavia kind of misses. It's been ground flat by glaciers, so it doesn't have a lot of topography.
Like Copenhagen's a food mecca, but the city itself is a bit grim.
I want to get back. I feel so close. I feel a bit guilty, but I do have to kind of make my way to California. So I'm not sure how long I'll be in Scandinavia for, but I'm loving it. It's awesome. Like that ice plunge today was bullshit. That was a lot of fun. A lot of positive endorphins got released during those few moments.
Wow.
That's
good.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. Well, I'll try to do it up north as well when the ice will be like that thick. There's a few of us doing it. It sounds like a pretty epic tour. I mean, and how is this all? Are we going to see like new Instagram posts as you go? Do you post as you do it, kind of after each one, or you just kind of sit down and do it all at once?
No, I post as I'm going around. So I'll have lunch and then go sit in a bar or in a hotel room and post. So I do stories along the way. So I just post stories. My actual Instagram posts are about 8 months behind because I only post twice a day. So if you have a meal that's 20 dishes, then it takes 10 days to post it. So that's a month behind on the actual. The stories are sort of day to day, which I keep up with when I'm doing the tours. And you get a lot of interaction. You get quite a lot of people watching, quite a lot of chefs watching, and taking note of where you're going and asking questions. So that's also part of the fun of it, that you kind of feel like you've got these people watching what you're doing and are actually interested.
I've noticed that too, with my social media as well. Like you end up feeling like much more a part of the community than ever before, where people are interacting and asking questions, and it's really, I don't know, fulfilling is the right word, but it's great to give back and give information. Like I check to follow along and always have time to answer questions for people. But I wanted to ask you, the two posts per day, is that like an algorithm trick to keep it going? Because you can't just splutter everything out all at once. It won't get the same traction, right?
I haven't thought that deeply about it. I just post twice a day because it's kind of takes half an hour. It's just doesn't take too long. Seems like a good amount. It's always a bit annoying if you're following someone and suddenly they fill up your whole feed with 15 posts all at the same time or something. So I think a couple a day. People know that I'm always posting every day, so they're kind of it's not. I mean, they know that I post regularly. But no, I didn't think, I haven't really thought, what's the best way to build the account? It just sort of gradually happens. And I think now the more followers I have, the sort of faster it grows. It's interesting. It's weird, but interesting. Because it wasn't anything, I never thought I want to like get a big Instagram account. I mean, it's not really a big Instagram account, is it? It's not,
kind of 200 million
like Britney Spears or something.
I think that's another level, another universe. Yeah. I think the two posts a day, honestly, it's doable. It's like responsible to yourself, to your time, and not being just wasting your days stuck on the phone. And plus, like, I think at that pace, it gives you the timing to post accurately, to have like, talk about the dish, talk about what you felt about it. If you're just to like chuck down 16 or 15 or whatever that whole tasting menu was, then the audience is not going to have the patience for it. And you're going to be in your phone for 2 hours just getting that up. And I think 2 a day is great.
Yeah.
I like that you didn't research the algorithm. I like that you're just like, fuck it. That's what works for me. And that's what's happening. It is annoying, I'm sure, to be 8 months behind when you want to post the most current stuff, but I think it's the right pace.
Yeah. I think that also the restaurant gets longer exposure. So if you just post a whole meal from one restaurant in one post or in two posts, then that's it. That's the only sort of exposure that that restaurant will get. Whereas if I'm posting, you know, a restaurant, like at the moment, I'm posting a place called Il Ferro di Capo d'Orso in Italy, which is like 20 courses. So I'm posting him every day for about 10 days. So he has 10 days worth of a tiny amount of publicity, but publicity nonetheless.
It helps. Does this exposure to the restaurants? Does that help you get reservations? Has it benefited you in any way?
It does. Now and again, it does.
You worked hard, man.
I mean, I think a lot of chefs, generally speaking, chefs like other chefs, so that they enjoy cooking for other chefs, I think. And also, I think they like people like me that spend all their money and all their time traveling around eating in restaurants, that they're super enthusiastic about it and not going around critiquing them too much. You know, they're going purely for the enjoyment of eating. I think chefs appreciate that and they like that. So it helps to get reservations for sure. But to be honest, you don't need a lot of help getting reservations. It's if you plan in advance, a long way
that's
in advance,
my issue.
Then it's easy enough to get in most restaurants. It's fairly straightforward. If you just make a note of when they're releasing their reservations and on that day book your table, it's fairly straightforward. There's only a few that are like super hard. And then you have to pull out the secret tricks and to the chefs and stuff like that. But it's interesting, the Instagram account, like, so today something happened. Marina O'Loughlin of the Sunday Times, she's a food critic on there. She reviewed a restaurant, or she published the review today in the Sunday Times for a place up near Newcastle called Pine. Pine invited me to go and eat there. Just because they're a bit out of the way and they saw that I eat out a lot, and I was planning a trip in the UK, and they said, hey, come up and see us because I think you'll really like it. So I went up, loved it, tagged Marina in a little message saying you've definitely got to check this place out. And then 2 months later, they get like the review they got today was like incredible. So I was just so pleased that kind of little circle from them getting in touch with me enjoying the meal, mentioning it to her, and then she goes to the restaurant, and then today they get this incredible review, and they'll be fully booked forever now. It'll be really hard to get a table there, but it's really, I love that when you can recommend a restaurant to someone, even if I just send you to those places I sent you in Stockholm saying, hey, go there, I think you'll like these places. But if you can do that and it gets in a national newspaper, you've got all these people that have got their eye now on this restaurant. I think it's fucking great. Really, really good. Really fantastic.
Absolutely. It's such a positive experience on kind of all fronts. And you're obviously enjoying yourself as a chef, toying around eating, and then also, to expose people to little hidden gems is, it's got to feel good when it just works out that way.
Yeah, for sure.
You mentioned food photography and taking, like, because this question pertains directly to me, so this might be a little more selfish, but like, do you bring like a certain kind of rig? Do you just use your phone? Do you ask permission? How does that conversation go ahead of time?
I was giggling there because I have a lot of friends that I eat with that do take full on rigs and lighting stuff and go a bit over the top crazy. I just use my phone, so I always like keep up to date with the iPhone, and they have a great camera on the iPhone, as you know. So I just use that, and then a tiny bit of editing just in the Photos app afterwards. But yeah, people that I eat with that travel around with SLR cameras and or a couple of cameras, they want the picture on the phone and they want the picture with the camera. Yeah. And then I'll eat with people that are actually interrupting the flow of the meal because they're taking, you know, professional shots with tripods and stuff, which is fine if you've arranged that already with the restaurant. If it's you know, something that's been arranged. It's a bit annoying when I'm eating with these people and the meal takes twice as long because they're doing that. But I think there's got to be a balance of where you're respecting, you know, the chef and the restaurant and the pace of the meal that he's intending, between how long you're taking, you know, taking pictures and photos. I'm pretty quick now, so I don't, you know, mess around too much. And also I learned, like, if you do sit there for ages taking, you know, 15, 20 photos of one dish to get the right shot, it takes you 10 times as long editing afterwards. So I always just take, you know, one or two quick snaps of a dish and you know, then eat it, you know?
Ah, I hear you. Yeah, I think the phone is the way forward. Like, I'm a Google Pixel fanboy myself because it's whoever comes out first, either Samsung, Apple, like whoever is the newest phone has the best camera. And it's challenging too, because as you know, like every dining room has different lighting. I mean, Disfrutar was really bright. La Sarte's the next week was dark. So, and to bring a rig, I'm a bit gun shy too, because I went to Room for Dessert in Bali like a few times. Actually, I loved it. And I remember meeting the chef and I was like, hey, do you mind if I come back and, you know, do a little like bring a camera? He's like, please no. It's like really disruptive to everyone else's dining experience. And since then I've been really like, I guess I'm going to use the term camera shy, but I've been kind of like, well, I don't even ask. I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, I'm the same. I think if I, you know, I give myself a slap sometimes because I walk into a restaurant and I find myself looking at the lights, and then if I'm like directed to my table,
sit over there.
I'm eating on my own. Yeah, I haven't changed tables yet, but I do like select the chair that I'm going to sit in depending on the shadow, and I'm like, God, am I really that guy now?
But it takes 5 seconds of thought. You know, it's worth it if you put that 5 seconds of thought into like. But everything's better. It's not that big of a. You're not. I don't think any one of us is being that guy, but I think bringing a tripod into a dining room is a bit over the top, like, because everyone's gonna look, you know, like the whole dining room's gonna look. I can't remember the chef's name, but he was super cool, the guy at Room for Dessert, and that was kind of like his point, like it's disruptive for everyone else. So as discreet as I can be, and actually just did, I ate at Grano in Gothenburg and it was super good, and I had a little tiny tripod and I just won't do that again. I'm like, oh, look at. Like, I was at the first seating, it was 4 o'clock, there was no one there, but then it got full, and then anyway,
it's hard, there man. Was this period of time when there was a few restaurants that were banning photography outright, like, so
Ramsay did for a while,
like Adria, I think so, yeah, Adria at I forgot the name, in Barcelona, sort of
41 degrees tickets.
No, it's Enigma. So Enigma was the restaurant. They had a thing. Yeah, they are apparently going to reopen, which is good. But they had a thing where, they banned photography when they first opened. So, and everyone was like, well, okay, that's fair enough. If you don't want people to take photos, then they don't have to take photos. But then they realized very quickly that they were getting no publicity. All this free publicity that you get from, you know, 100 people every day taking photos of your food and posting it online.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's valuable, you know, it's free and it's of value. So they sort of relaxed the ban very quickly, and you could now take photos. And there's another place in, actually in Stockholm, Noble Heart and Schmutzig in Stockholm, they have a ban on photography. And Punk Royale also have a ban on photography.
I can't get into those places. They're so booked.
Yeah, they're hard. I don't know how I feel about it, really, because I'm like, well, I'm paying for this meal. I'm not going to be disruptive. I'm just going to take a couple of quick pictures. Yeah. I totally get it. If you're disturbing the people around you with whatever you're doing, setting up, tripods and lighting, shit like that, then of course, then absolutely. Yeah. But if you're just the guy spending $200 on a meal, then I want to be able to take a picture of what I'm eating.
Yeah, for a simple fact, a memory, not even for anything else other than a memory. I wonder if kind of the way this came about, like the timeline of it, was because for a while phone cameras were kind of shitty, and now they've gotten to a level where, and I think people were probably taking really terrible photos with a flash, and you know, flashes make most things look really bad unless you're pro level with the right camera and the speed settings and all that shit. So I wonder, because I see some of my old food photos from like 2000 and it was done with a flash. They're horrible. So I think even a bad camera phone would make a really amazing 3-star meal look like shit. But I think those days are over where the phones are incredible. Yeah. Like to record.
You'd be surprised though. But I think it takes a little bit of skill to take get good photos. But obviously, the phones these days are so good that, they really help. But I think anything like that's like beneficial to the restaurant and to the chef, because it's all good publicity. That's
a good point.
You know? And it's free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because it's open. You know, it's like, also I think within chefs as a community, within ourselves, we've become much more open for information. Like there's no more secret recipes. There's like that almost doesn't exist anymore, because it's just do a Google search, you know, it's all there. And I think that's great. And I think that's I've been cooking food professionally for almost 30 years now, and to see the change of access to information, it just, everyone's level comes up, because there's no secrets anymore. You don't have to go to Italy to learn Italian food. You can really watch some pretty kick-ass chefs on YouTube and watch the technique, you know? And that's just one example of what I'm talking about. So I love that idea of, well, you can't really hide pictures of your food as a restaurant. It's like, they're out there. Don't worry about it. It's more courageous, I think.
Yeah.
Less kind of wimpy.
Yeah, yeah. So take it as flattery if people are using your... Exactly. Photographs of your dishes and stuff. For sure.
Sick. Well, I'm getting hungry, so I should probably go out to the white icy streets of Stockholm and see what kind of amazing food I can scrounge up on a Sunday night.
Astoria should be easy to get into.
You think so? That's way out. Oh, that's way on the peninsula. That looks pretty dope. I will check that out. But the
Astoria is in the city center.
Okay,
it's on the main, right in the middle, but it's a massive
I'm thinking of Ara, AIRA.
It was like 15 minutes in a taxi.
They all look amazing though. This trip has been so last minute though, I'm struggling a little bit, but that's neither here nor there. Well, I know you got to get back to your boat life there in the sunny Caribbean. I'm going to go put on my hat and my 8 layers and some gloves and just get out there, have some amazing, amazing food. But I really, thanks a lot for sharing your story, man. It was really cool. I think a lot of, myself, I'm just going to include myself. Like I think I'm an expert at dining out and Michelin stars and all, but like you have kind of taking the level up, and I think I know I appreciate these tips and these other resources that you mentioned. I'm sure other chefs do, just to make it kind of easier to find amazing meals out. Thanks for coming on. Get the fork out.
No problem. Cool, thanks for having me.
Cheers. All right, stick around. Bye. For a little bit after. That's it, everyone. Thank you, hope you enjoyed. Take care.